2021年到2023年期间担任美国国务院负责中国与台湾事务的副助理国务卿华自强 Rick Waters 日前接受美国之音中文部国务院记者卡拉专访，就当前美中关系的前景与挑战进行了深入分析。华自强在国务院中国事务协调办公室，也就是所称的中国屋，于2022年年底成立时被任命为该办公室的首任负责人。过去30年来，作为美国职业外交官，他站在美国对外工作最前线，有许多和中方高级官员打交道的第一手经验。他在专访中也分享了这些宝贵经历和观察，并且对台海局势、中俄关系以及习近平政府的战狼外交策略发表看法。
It's been almost a year since President Biden and President Xi Jinping met in California, where they set up guardrails for U.S.-China relations and vowed to keep communication channels open. And after that, many rounds of talks at different levels has taken place. So I wonder, how do you evaluate the progress? And do you see real meaningful results coming from these meetings?
Well, I think we have to look at this Woodside Summit as the culmination of a number of things that happened in the administration. The first is that for the first period, Biden was focused on rebuilding the U.S.'s domestic strength and reinvigorating partnerships and alliances globally. And then from that position, dealing with China from a position of relative strength. So during that first two-year period, the U.S.-China relationship was in some ways arguably not the priority. It was important, but it was managed largely through leader-level diplomacy, which in China's current political configuration is the most important channel. And then we know what happened in 2022. Circumstances around the visit of former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, led to a downward spiral. And Biden and Xi made an initial effort to stabilize relations that fall at their summit in Bali. But it only made it a few months, and then the surveillance balloon knocked things sideways again. So I think what we have now is a little bit more stable floor built around the leader-level channels, a few modest areas where there is some common work underway, and a web of senior empowered channels at the cabinet level, including Jake Sullivan, who try to manage conflict and competition, rather, within bounds, within guardrails, to avoid the scenario of unmitigated downward spiral we saw in 2022.
But it seems after the last meeting between President Biden and President Xi, they resumed the mill-to-mill level talks. They're talking about cooperation on fentanyl. Do you think the real, like the crucial, substantial topics have been discussed enough?
Well, I think that it's always important to keep channels open, but for a number of reasons. One is, at points in the U.S.-China relationship when the two sides aren't talking, there is a tendency sometimes for each side to misunderstand the intentions of the other. And what that means is you can sometimes go from a baseline of competition to a greater level of volatility because both sides are reacting to what they think the other is doing. So that's one modest objective. But the second is that I do think there are some areas where, not as favors for each other, but just as a practical reality, the two sides actually have some overlap in their interest. And military-to-military relations is a good example. You're not going to resolve disputes over Taiwan or the South China Sea in those channels, but I don't think either leader wants a military mishap to put them in a corner where they might have to contend with escalation or even worse, conflict. So that's the modest objective of some of these channels that have emerged, to keep the situation stable, even within the broader context of a fundamentally competitive U.S.-China relationship.
The U.S. has repeatedly said that we're going to compete with China, but we're not looking for conflicts. But if there was to be a conflict, I think maybe Taiwan could be one of the issues that sparked that conflict. So, and also in China, Xi Jinping has repeatedly said that this so-called reunification with Taiwan is inevitable, and China is trying to gain increasingly more capacity to do it. So do you think this Chinese invasion to Taiwan is inevitable? And what should the United States do to deter that invasion?
Well, nothing's inevitable. But I think we should start, when we look at the Taiwan issue, by recognizing that the U.S. and China have had a difference of views on this issue for longer than you and I have been alive, and it hasn't resulted in war. So while neither side is perfectly happy with the issue, China objecting to U.S. arms transfers, the U.S. objecting to, most recently, this extraordinary PLA modernization effort, and rhetoric that implies that the leadership has a greater sense of urgency on the issue, I don't think that conflict is inevitable. And I think at its core, the U.S.'s interest is peace and stability. That's what's anchored the prosperity in the Indo-Pacific over the past couple of decades, the ability for commerce, for trade, for people-to-people flows regionally to thrive in an environment where there is no war. And so I think if we take that as our starting point, I don't think that conflict is inevitable, but I do think that the U.S. and Taiwan are focused very much on the question of how to ensure that the leadership in Beijing never believe they have a viable military option at an acceptable cost. And if that condition holds, then I think it will fall to the diplomats and to the channels that exist between the parties to manage this issue carefully.
But what do you think is in Xi Jinping's mind? Does any deterrence strategy matter to him?
Well, I can't speak for what's in Xi Jinping's mind, but I think we can look at this problem set, you know, from an objective perspective. I mean, yes, the PLA modernization effort is extraordinary. It is a historically unprecedented level of build-out, both conventional and in emerging domains such as space, nuclear, and cyber. It is directed fundamentally at Taiwan contingencies. But I also think what you're seeing in Taiwan itself is a greater focus by the current leadership on building out Taiwan's asymmetric defense in the face of what is happening, and a mobilization of the civilian structures in the way that the Baltic countries and others do to ensure that the cross-border amphibious invasion is not only difficult from a military perspective, but Beijing would be left with fundamental questions about how to hold an island where the civilian population itself is mobilized. So again, this is not a strategy that is meant to provoke conflict. This is meant to increase deterrence to allow greater scope for political management of the issue.
During your career as a U.S. diplomat, you have not only have a front seat role, you are actually out there on the stage to shape U.S.-China relations. So I would love to learn more about your first-hand experience dealing with your Chinese counterparts. So how are they like? How are they different? And what are some striking and maybe most challenging aspects or moments that left an impression on you?
Well, I've been fortunate to deal with Chinese diplomats for the better part of 30 years. And what I will say is, irrespective of what you think of China's policy or political system, they do have a very professional diplomatic core. They've got very talented people in the system. What I think has changed over the past few decades is it's a much more disciplined system. So it's very difficult, especially in official meetings, for Chinese diplomats to move too far off of the established line. So I don't think that we should misunderstand the level of talent in the system when we look at it through its structural constraints. But I do think that as China's overall foreign policy has become more assertive, as you know, the leadership has talked about China playing a greater role on the international stage, it has gone through periods where the wolf warriorism, the change in tone from the podium, has characterized a different era of Chinese diplomacy than what we saw before. But I actually think in some ways there are plenty in the system who understand the counterproductive nature of those tactics. And I've seen a little bit of a tactical recalibration over recent years in how they express their foreign policy views publicly.
And also, we've heard all these anecdotes about Chinese diplomats, about how they have to stick to their script and there's very little wiggle room. In your experience, is it like that?
I think we have to look at this not just from the perspective of China. That's actually very typical of authoritarian systems. I mean, I've met with Libyan diplomats in a previous era who are very similar. So it's to me, a systems issue, not an individual issue. These are very disciplined authoritarian systems where the message is conveyed very clearly and precisely. The U.S. is a little bit more like improvisational jazz. We get the general thrust of the message out there, but it's not always quite as precise. But it does give you more license as a diplomat to try to shape and tailor your thinking.
China is obviously not hiding their brightness, biding their time anymore.
Yeah.
So what is the reason behind this pivot, if you will, of their diplomatic strategy?
Well, I think it was a natural progression in some ways as their GDP, as their national power grew, as they became the largest trading nation in the world 10 years ago. There's going to be a natural tendency of any country to play a greater role internationally. I think the challenge is the particular way in which that national ambition is being expressed, whether it's an effort to reshape aspects of the international order in a way that fundamentally challenges things that are important to Americans, whether it is within China's immediate region, a greater assertiveness towards Japan or South China Sea claimants or along the line of actual control with India. I think in the economic realm, it has become a greater challenge to manage the implications of China's economic model as its scale has increased, because a balance of payments surplus a decade ago is very different from the same percentage rate balance of payment surplus today. And in the technology realm, I think the challenge for both governments is that technology moves much faster than the structures of government can consider it or regulate it. And so this is a core area of U.S.-China strategic competition where both sides are becoming more competitive and more charged.
Can you maybe elaborate on how their tactic recalibration has changed their international image?
You know, I think really the issue is that wolf warriorism can be very satisfying if you're speaking to your domestic audience, but I think it actually grates on the ears of many other countries who, and look, to be frank, I mean, I've seen this in U.S. diplomacy as well. I think what third countries generally are hoping from the U.S. and China is to manage the relationship responsibly. But it's not quite as simple as that. And I think where the strategic communications piece of it comes in is sometimes when you sound too wolf warrior, you sound irresponsible or reckless or brash. And so again, it may work in one's internal politics, but it very seldom helps with the coalition of third countries who form these shifting coalitions around different issues that ultimately may be the deciding factor between whether Beijing gets its way or Washington gets its way.
And I guess in your discussions or debates with colleagues and counterparts, the name Xi Jinping might have come up pretty often.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you think of him as a person, as a leader, and what do you think his vision is for China and for U.S.-China relations?
Well, I don't profess to have been, you know, in enough meetings with Xi Jinping to have a deep sense of the person. But what I can say is that I think over the course of his tenure, both in previous roles and in the role he's in, he's laid out through a canon of speeches, some private and some public, a worldview, a vision for China's national rejuvenation. And it has many component parts. And I think the question in my mind is not just what that vision is and where his vision and the U.S. vision run counter to each other. But to me, it's not preordained that either side can ultimately achieve certain ambitions. I mean, I think as I look at where the Chinese economy is today, it could very well have implications for the ability to achieve certain ambitions. We have to be modest in those projections and admit what we don't know. But I actually think that today is the most important question.
I think before Xi took power in China, there has been this U.S. engagement policy towards China, thinking that by engaging with China more, China could be more open, at least. But it just seems what's happening now is quite on the contrary to that. So what do you think the United States could do to maybe bring China back on that track? Or is there still aspiration to bring back China on that track?
You know, personally, I think the engagement label is a little bit too polarizing. I think it's actually normal for countries to talk to friends, competitors, adversaries alike. It happens all the time. The U.S. talked to the Taliban in the depths of the Afghanistan war. To me, having communication channels is not the issue. The question is, how do you use them? And I think that's where the distinction lies. 15 or 20 years ago, the goal was to use those channels to help affect an evolution of aspects of Chinese policy directly with the system. I think what has changed today is that the goal of those channels is different. It's meant to ensure each side has a clear understanding of the intentions of the other, to manage tactical issues responsibly. But there's also an element of this which, again, gets to the broader question of how third countries, these important coalitions, see the U.S. Because if they don't see the U.S. trying, they will often conclude that it is the U.S. that is the irresponsible partner. And so we have to remember that some element of the use of senior-level empowered channels today isn't just about China. It's about shaping the environment around China through this ever-shifting network of coalitions.
As, you know, Secretary Blinken has repeatedly said that China is, and I quote here, China is the only country with both the intent to reshape the international order and increasingly the economic, diplomatic, military, and technical power to do it.
Yeah.
And in this context, how should the U.S. adjust its policy towards China or deal with China?
Well, I think the quote you're mentioning from Secretary Blinken's speech 2 years ago that laid down the architecture of this administration's China policy, I think it kind of hits at what I'm talking about, that in the previous era, you were using those channels for a different purpose. You were trying to negotiate big framework agreements. You were trying to incentivize debates over reform, you know, by some definition, in the Chinese system. I think that era has given way to this newer period where the channels have a different function. And so even if the two sides are fundamentally at odds on an issue, as we see in areas like the relationship between the militaries, there still is an interest in avoiding unintended conflict. So you repurpose the channels around these newer goals.
I'd also to ask about this China-Russia relations.
Mm-hmm.
What's the dynamics between China and Russia, between Xi and Putin? Because China and Russia just carry out this one of the largest scale exercise in Indo-Pacific, and they're increasing their cooperation in that area. So what's the dynamics behind that? And do you think United States have understood that dynamics enough?
Well, look, I think we always have to be modest in updating our understanding. But I do think that what is clear at this point is that the relationship between China and Russia has evolved in a very consequential direction over the past 10 years. And it's primarily a relationship at the top. And it's driven by, I think, shared fears and paranoias about U.S. intentions. It was born in that period of the color revolutions in the Arab Spring, that both in Beijing and Moscow, there were fears that those could spread into their territory. But I think in the time since, this has become more of a geopolitical hedge against what China perceives as an Asian NATO emerging in its backyard. And I think the objective reality is much more of one of a security dilemma, where countries in the immediate Indo-Pacific region see the growth of power in Beijing, see a lack of transparency over the intentions, and see a greater assertiveness and willingness to use that power to achieve its objectives. And they are naturally looking to each other and to Washington as a hedge. So you're seeing the repurposing of the Quad mechanism, which began after the tsunami 20 years ago as a humanitarian relief structure. Now it works on issues like maritime domain awareness. You're seeing the AUKUS agreement between the US, the UK, and Australia. These new trilateral mechanisms, including the historic Camp David summit between South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. And I think these dynamics are all interrelated. Those countries are reacting to perceived fears of China, and that is leading China to deepen its hedge in the Russia relationship in return.
Yeah, exactly like you said, because there are arguments saying that it is exactly the international Quad or AUKUS like that, or a U.S. strategy like that, or sanctions that pushed China towards Russia.
Right. And, those narratives are there. And I think we have to listen to the narratives from each side. But I think, to me, the more objective reality is that if China were managing its ambitions through peaceful means, conflict resolution, arbitrations, dispute settlement mechanisms, generally agreed upon frameworks that govern sovereignty, freedom of navigation, and the law of the sea, that would present a very different picture to the countries in the region than what we're seeing today, where there's essentially a new set of norms that China is trying to assert in the South and East China Sea and along its borders. And it's in that environment where it's very difficult to argue that the defensive measures of many of these countries are meant as a provocation to China.
But do you think this peaceful management is something we can expect from Xi Jinping's administration?
Well, I mean, I think that's where deterrence comes in. It depends on the perceived costs in Beijing. And one worries that if the perception of cost is too low, it creates incentives to use these tools to achieve certain territorial and other objectives.
So in this election season, the Biden administration's China policy has often been criticized by the Republican campaign for being too weak. What is your take on that?
Well, we're in an election campaign, so obviously you're never going to hear anyone say that someone's policy is too tough. I think the honest reality is that this election is not really, in my view, about China. It's about other issues. China is present. But if you look at, how much it featured in the speeches at the Republican and Democratic conventions, there are issues related to China that are important. But I think we have to maintain that perspective. Second, I think that the issues that, in my view, matter most to voters center around trade and a perception of unfairness, a lack of reciprocity, and fentanyl, which, for a number of years is a problem that has had a direct relationship to the producers of these precursor chemicals in China. And so I think those types of issues do matter on the margins, but they're not central to U.S. voters, particularly in the swing states that will decide this election.
What about for China, for the observers in China who are looking at this election? How is Harris's China policy going to be different than President Biden's? And what awaits China if Trump regains power?
Well, look, I mean, I can offer my view on that. I think how this is playing in China is a very different story. But I think what we have to say at this point is that we're in the midst of a campaign. So, to be fair to both candidates, what we should judge is, once they form their cabinets next spring, how will they translate political positions into new policy? I think, Harris's team have expressed a general view that her policy will be consistent with Biden's. The Trump team and President Trump himself have talked about aspects of the relationship, particularly trade, where they feel that things are out of balance. But again, I think we will only really know the answer to how policies diverge or remain consistent when cabinets are in place next spring and these new national security and economic teams have the chance to make their own mark on a Harris or a Trump administration.
So President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping are likely to meet and sit down again later this year. Mm-hmm. So what is your prospect for this meeting, and what would you like to see in this meeting that could make it more constructive or impactful?
Well, look, it'll be a critical moment because this meeting, which will be either on the margins of the G20 summit in Brazil or the APEC summit in Lima, Peru, depending on where it takes place, these meetings on the margins of summits are consequential during a presidential transition. I think they can use it as a chance to help bridge between the two administrations. That will be easier if it's a Biden to Harris transition because a Democrat to Democrat is more likely to be able to talk about how the bridging will work. But if it's, Biden to Trump, I still think it's consequential. President Biden can give his advice about how to avoid returning to the events of 2022, how they can reflect on the lessons of what has been achieved since the Woodside Summit, And I think you probably go into it with fairly modest expectations.
I understand lots of talks are carried out between leader to leader at this level of meetings. So how much is decided by the leaders and how much is decided by the cabinet members?
Well, I think the systems are very different. I mean, the U.S. system is much more of a bottom-up system where, yes, China policy is decided by a sitting president, but there are many aspects and dimensions to that policy that play out at the cabinet level in interplay between the U.S. executive and legislative branch, etc. In the Chinese system, U.S. policy is set at the top. And so you have to have clear signals to the bureaucracy for them to be empowered to engage on any particular issue. And that's particularly true at times when the relationship has become more tense. So I think that is my general description of how the official channels work. Now, we have to remember that those are not the entirety of the relationship. There are still business channels. There is still a $560 billion two-way trading relationship. And the relationship between the societies, while it has shrunk, particularly during the period of COVID, remains robust, if a little bit skewed more towards Chinese leaving to come here than U.S. Students and scholars going in the other direction.
And I know you're also following all this China affairs, domestic affairs,
yeah,
pretty closely. So what are some current affairs or some news that strikes you the most?
In China or
in
here?
China.
Oh, my goodness. I think for most ordinary Chinese, it's the state of the economy. It's the property market. It's the fact that education, healthcare are becoming more difficult, more expensive to access. And again, these are problems that are a function, I think, of a structural transformation of the economy that's in a very difficult point that was accentuated by the cyclical nature of the property downturn and the lack of a real rebound after the period of COVID lockdowns. So it's really hard to say when these problems will get better. But I think for ordinary Chinese, like ordinary people anywhere, my sense when I come and go from the country is that, yeah, they focus on bigger issues from time to time, but a lot of it is their ordinary life and how these economic and social factors affect them.
We heard about, we have the U.S., the United States would like to improve this people-to-people relations with China.
Yeah.
But do you see that picking up in the near future?
Well, I think that there are a number of challenges. I mean, at a certain level, both sides have an interest, I think, in having their societies connected because that's important to understanding each other. It's important to communicating clearly the realities in either direction. It's important for study. It's important for scholars. There is value in those channels. But they're being tested, and they're being tested in unprecedented ways by the use of influence tools, united front activities, such as we see in this alleged instance in New York. They're being tested by the use of what are called non-traditional collectors, people who are doing kind of borderline espionage work when they're in the U.S. for tourism or business. And so while this is a very small portion of the overall pie, it does tend to color the equation. And I think the key is going to be, how do you find ways to protect the good while having law enforcement agencies clinically and surgically deal with the challenges? That, to me, is really the ideal equation.
And my last question, since you've been working on China for almost three decades, as you said, how do you think the American regular people's view on China changed in the past decade?
Well, it's interesting. Polling shows that Americans are very concerned about many aspects of Chinese policy. They're very concerned about the perception of unfairness, about the theft of intellectual property, about the fentanyl scourge and how it relates to some aspects of Chinese enforcement of fentanyl precursor exports. But I also think what's interesting when you look at the polling is that Americans don't want to go to war with China. Americans don't want conflict, and they don't hate ordinary Chinese. And I think that's important to bear in mind because China is a quarter of humanity. It is still 18% of the global economy, And irrespective of what its future trajectory looks like, the two countries are going to have to find a way to coexist.
Thank you so much for answering so many questions from us.
Of course. Good to see you.